You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here at rickemerson.com. And Mick Jagger once said that every singer, that all vocalists were merely this conglomeration of their influences. They said, he said that every vocalist was, in effect, a pastiche of all those performers who had inspired or shaped them. And it is, I think, the same way with any form of entertainment or arts, and I am certainly no exception to that. To hear this program or to hear anything that I've done is to hear a wide variety of source materials, things that are filtered through my own mutations, my own sensibility. Stan Freberg, Alan Sherman, Spike Jones, the pop culture obsessions of Weird Al Yankovic, they have all played a part in forming the tone and style of what I do every day. And they, in turn, were all brought to me and to many, many millions of people by our next guest. He is a graduate of Portland's own Reed College. He has been on the air in one form or another for 50-odd years, and I do mean odd in the very best sense of the word. He has been a roadie and A&R man and is a respected author and musicologist. His folks may have called him Barrett, but to myself and to untold others, he is simply the one and only Dr. Demento. Welcome to the Rick Emerson radio program, my friend.
Woo woo! Wind up your radio. Hi, Rick.
How are you on this very fine Wednesday?
Oh, real fine. It's warm here in Southern California. I'm getting ready to do a show. I'll be recording a show a little later for our website at drdemento.com. My life really hasn't changed much since we've gone to internet radio as opposed to the other kind. I still do a show every week, and it takes a long time to go through all the new music that's out and go through all the requests I get to play older things and put a show together that hopefully will entertain people. So I do that every week, just like I always have.
Let's actually just get right into it and talk about some of the things that have been up with you recently. On June 6th, you announced that your broadcasts on what I guess I am legally required to call terrestrial radio were ceasing, and you were moving to the internet. Tell me a little bit about what led up to that and where you go from here.
Well, we were just a radio network, shall I say, had shrunk a little bit over the years due to various changes that would take a long time to explain that are going on in terrestrial radio, and our internet show meantime had been growing consistently, so we just decided to concentrate on that. Actually, there's a little footnote to that. After we had made the announcement and announced that we were no longer going to supply the show to terrestrial radio stations, one college station in Amarillo, Texas turned out to have a contract to carry the show for several months more, and not wanting to give them their money back or get lawyers involved, we are still giving them a copy of the show. Other than that, it's internet only, drdemento.com, full speed ahead into cyberspace.
Was it something you'd been anticipating for some time? That you've worked in radio long enough, did you have a sense that this was sort of on the horizon, this kind of change?
Oh, yes. I mean, I guess the final straw was when our station in Chicago decided to go in a different direction with their Sunday evening. So that had been kind of our flagship for a while.
What has been the reaction of the audience? You've always had a very tech savvy and a very an audience that was very plugged into science and technology. How have they embraced the change?
Well, for the ones who have been listening on the internet, it made no difference at all. Except perhaps that I can be a little looser in what I play, the language and things like that. For the radio listeners, the unfortunately rather small number that remained, they just either have to move over to the internet and perhaps improve their broadband access, or just live with their memories, I guess. But we've certainly encouraged them to move to the internet, and a lot of them have from the response that we get.
There was a time in your life for over a decade you were part of this radio station that has become really legendary, especially for other radio folks, and that's KMET, which was immortalized in Jim Ladd's book Radio Waves, where he referred to it as radio chaos. What was, just as a big radio nerd, I have to ask you this question. What was the atmosphere like at that time at that station? What was it like to be at the center of that kind of broadcasting universe?
Well, it was very exciting. I mean, it's Jim Ladd's book, of course, was partly fictionalized, but the spirit of it is true. A lot of the personalities are just like they were. So it was exciting, especially during the years that the station was at the top of the heap. It could be tense at times. Certainly one of the more memorable characters in Jim Ladd's book was the station manager, the hound, as everybody called him. That's what we called him in real life, too. He was a good man. He actually was a fan of my show. I got along fine with him, but some of the other people did not.
At that time in radio working, and I guess what was called, or what we at least call now, Freeform FM or Progressive FM, it was certainly a place where there was a bit of a blank slate, and a show like yours could go on the air without any sort of precedent. There was nothing like it that existed, and it could find a wide audience.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I guess there's an element of good fortune in that I came along right at that time during the 4 or 5 year window where progressive freeform underground radio flourished in Los Angeles, certainly, and a number of other cities as well. That was a pretty short window, maybe 1967 to 73, something like that. At KMET, I saw the whole process of freeform radio evolving into a more formal sort of rock radio. When I started, the station that I started at, KPPC in Pasadena, California, it really was freeform. The disc jockeys could and did play anything they darn pleased. Of course, they were judged to some extent on how entertaining they were and on the number of people who listened. But it was very wide-ranging. They had a very large library, and they could go, they could segue from Jimi Hendrix into Bach, and often did things like that.
Do you see parallels between the FM radio of that time and internet broadcasting, in the sense that it really is just a wide open field, and it is up to the individual broadcaster to find a formula that resonates with X number of people, but the rules are your own to make?
Well, now that you mention it, yes, there is a considerable parallel phenomenon there, sure.
I am endlessly fascinated by asking radio broadcasters how they got into the field, what their first exposure to radio was, and what drew them to it. How did it begin for you? What brought you to radio initially?
Oh, just that I like records for people. It kind of started with my playing records for the sock hops at my high school, and I realized that especially like introducing unfamiliar material that they would come to like. That was, I got quite a charge out of things like that. So being on the radio is like a larger version of that, playing records for an audience, introducing people to new stuff or old stuff that they haven't heard before that they come to enjoy. That was kind of credo of my show. I was influenced more by that than by any particular radio personalities that I heard, though there were some that did influence me. A guy named Stephen Kleen at KPPC, who I met at a party, and it was really due to him that I got started at KPPC. And certainly I watched him work and absorbed a lot from that. Mostly it was I was a fan of music and of records rather than of any particular radio personality.
Am I remembering the story correctly? Stephen Kleen, I believe, is the one who gave you the moniker of led to the moniker of Dr. Demento. That he made a reference to it.
Yeah, that is true.
A record you had played. It was what was the story there? It was a nervous record, I think.
Well, yeah. The way I remember it is that I was playing this record by Nervous, Transfusion, which had been a hit in 1956. Transfusion, just a solid mess of contusions. Never, never, never could speed again. That was the hit song in 1956, and I was playing it there in 1970 on one of my first appearances on KPPC. And the way I remember it, one of the station employees just commented, "You got to be demented to play that on radio." And Stephen was there in the room, and the next week he started calling me Dr. Demento. Stephen maintained later on, when I saw him later, that he had thought of the name Dr. Demento sometime before that. He kind of envisioned Dr. Demento as being this magical character who knows everything there is to know about music. And he says he thought it up one night when he was hanging out with Peter Wolf, who you may remember as the lead singer of the Jay Giles band that had a bunch of hits in the 80s.
You attended Reed College right here in Portland, and you went after Reed to UCLA, and you got a master's degree in ethnomusicology, which even as the 60s were getting underway, getting a degree in ethnomusicology must have been something of a niche field of pursuit.
Yeah, actually, my degree was in folk music studies, that's what they called it, which is even more of a niche thing. But it was the 60s, folk music was all the rage, and on a popular and on academic level, too. So the folk music studies program was meant to train folklorists, to train researchers who would, like, go out into the field and collect old folk songs from old people back in the hills. That was kind of the atmosphere, what that program was all about. But I was very fascinated with traditional folk music at that time. I'd been exposed to the Folkways Anthology, a series of six LPs that had come out in 1952 and was recently reissued on CD and won a whole bunch of Grammys, so that's fairly famous. I fell under the spell of that. It's a collection of folk music recorded in the 1920s is what it is. And so by the time that I finished my degree at Reed, which was in classical music, I was all for studying folk music. And when I heard that UCLA had this program in folk music studies, I went down there and banged on the door, and they let me in, and so I got my degree. Wound up writing my thesis on the evolution of rhythm and blues music, or R&B, in the 1940s and early 50s. And that actually wound up getting me a job with a company called Specialty Records, which had recorded a lot of that music in the 40s and 50s. So they hired me to put together a series of LPs for them. So that was my day job at the time that the Dr. Demento show started.
If the Dr. Demento show had not become your primary gig, as they say, what do you see yourself doing in some parallel world? What would you have ended up doing as a career?
I would have worked for record companies. After Specialty, I went on to work for Warner Brothers Records and worked for them through most of the 70s. My day job while I was doing, while the Dr. Demento show was gradually growing. So I would probably have continued to work for record companies at least until recent years when the business kind of imploded, but I probably would have done that for a long time.
Is it true? Somebody told me that you lived at one point with the rock band Spirit. There was some the big communal house somewhere in the hills where you guys all, you all shared a pad together,
yeah,
as the kids said.
Yeah, that's true. As I was finishing up at UCLA, I got to know those guys. I met them at the Ashgrove, a folk club in Los Angeles, where I worked briefly while I was at UCLA. And I got to know those guys, and they said, oh, we're moving into this big house in Topanga. Why don't you come in with us? But you can have a room there. In fact, they gave me 2.5 rooms so that I could store my record collection. Shared that house for about 2 years until the band got successful enough so they each could get their own houses. Before I went to work for Specialty Records, I went through a spell where I wanted to be a record producer. I really wanted to be involved in making rock records, either as a producer. I wanted to be the next Phil Spector or the next Lou Adler, somebody like that, or I wanted to go out on the road, or both. The rock life was just real exciting to me, and the late 60s was a tremendously exciting time for rock music in Los Angeles. I got involved quite a bit with another pretty famous band, too, called Canned Heat. Boogie with Canned Heat, on the road again, going up the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, those guys were real good friends of mine, too, especially Alan Wilson, the fellow who sang On the Road Again and Going Up the Country.
Have you, I mean, as somebody, so you've been an A&R man, obviously the Dr. Demento show is how mainstream America came to know you. You were a roadie, you have a massive amount of knowledge of rhythm and blues and other forms of music as well. Have you thought about just writing all of this down and just sticking it into a massive, huge book about the life and times of Dr. Demento?
That would be real nice if I only had the time. I need to be two people.
Speaking of your record collection and the fact that the guys in Spirit, you had a second room or a third room or something in which you were keeping your records, how many records, I mean, just vinyl records maybe, are in your personal library? How much of that stuff do you own?
Oh, it's hundreds of thousands. I've lost count.
Did you have some massive homemade filing system for even tracking things? I mean, do you sort by genre? Do you sort alphabetically? I'm fascinated by the idea of keeping track of 300,000 records.
Well, basically, they're stored in alphabetical order by artists. They are in different categories. There's kind of the A list, which is here in the library room that adjoins my studio, and then others live in off-premises facilities around town. But yeah, there's the A list, and those are alphabetical order by artist, except for LPs, which are compilations. Those are alphabetical order by the record label, like all the Rhinos are together.
As somebody who has seen the evolution of music from vinyl through reel-to-reel to cassette to 8-track to CD to digital, is vinyl still your preferred format when it comes to listening to music as a fan? Is vinyl where you, is that how you choose to enjoy music?
No, I'm all for the digital method. I mean, I still got all these vinyl records, and I love them, but CDs are much easier to use in radio work. They queue up more or less automatically. You don't have to painstakingly clean each one before you put it in, and they're just so much easier to use, and you know, now that I can record a CD and nothing flat, either on the standalone machine I use to record the show or in my computer, I mean, that's so much easier than any other sort of recording that had been known before that. I mean, I expanded my library a whole lot in the 60s with my reel-to-reel recorder, but that was those are very cumbersome to use. I hated to have to wind to the 15th selection on a tape with 30 songs on it. That was very cumbersome.
Having moved to the internet with your show, and again, people can find out more about that at drdemento.com. You mentioned that a lot of the audience was already listening online, and you know the bulk of the folks are going to move along with you because you have such an amazingly loyal audience, regardless of the incarnation or whatever musical trend is in vogue. Your show really has sustained that audience of core folks that have followed you everywhere. What do you think is at the root of your listeners' incredible dedication that they have had over the years?
Oh, I think I respected them more than a lot of people on the radio. My whole mission was to open their minds to different forms of music, and I found that a way that I could do it was by making them laugh, by entertaining them through funny stuff. And that hadn't been my initial intent. Originally, it was just kind of a rare rock and roll show. But the more funny stuff that I played, the more popular the show got. So I thought, okay, that's the hook. That's what's going to make this happen.
Having been there for so many of conventional radio's defining eras and the evolutions of terrestrial radio, it must feel bittersweet to make transitions like this or to see the changes in recent years. What do you make of radio as an industry in 2010?
Well, it seems to be going for the lowest common denominator in a way, though perhaps more concrete explanation would be the growth of narrowcasting. In 1970, many stations were just looking for the most bodies they could get to listen to them, and they weren't quite as conscious of demographics. Later on, demographics came to rule everything as stations started narrowcasting. Narrowcasting means that they restrict their format to pretty much just one particular style of music and then sell their station to the advertisers as one that will appeal to people who like that music. Like, instead of just playing all kinds of rock and roll for anybody who'd like to listen, a station might decide that it's going to be an active rock station, which pretty much means that they play the sort of rock music that males 18 to 30 tend to like. And then they sell commercials to people who were trying to reach that audience, beer companies, anything to do with cars, that sort of thing. Or you'll have a station that appeals to young women, and then they can sell commercials for cosmetics and stuff like that. And so that sort of approach has come to rule terrestrial radio. Or you have a talk station that appeals to basically older white people, and then you sell commercials to people, you sell commercials for Depends or whatever.
As for the medium itself, what do you think that radio, terrestrial radio, will be or sound like in another 10 or 15 years? Can you even imagine what radio will sound like then?
Well, I suppose if I really knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be doing this little radio show for a living. I'd be a radio executive.
Fair enough.
Pulling in millions of dollars a year, if I really knew the answer to that.
Fair enough, my friend.
There have been many people have said that, the Internet is going to kill radio, just like people said television was going to kill radio back in 1950, and that did not happen. Radio managed to evolve and find a way that people could still make money. And one thing that might change things a lot is when it becomes easier to hear Internet radio in your car. I know a few people who are able to do that now by kind of rigging up something using cell phone technology. When that becomes something that the average person can do, that's going to considerably change the ground rules. I'm looking forward to that. I suppose you and I are both looking forward to that as people who are in the Internet radio biz.
It really is something that didn't... technology has advanced at such an exponential rate recently. I was talking to my wife about that today, where we go on the air here at around 1 o'clock Pacific, and we do a show for a couple hours, and I've been on in Portland for 12 years or so, and my wife is, on the days that she's home, has grown accustomed to just listening to this show, you know, via the radio, and now... It's exactly the same, except that she has a new smartphone. She has a Motorola Droid, and every day around 1 o'clock, she just punches up the show on her Droid and gets ready to listen. And to her, there was very little in the way of a transition. It was not much of a road, of a speed bump to her at all. She just moved from one medium to the next. And I think that is, it really is mind-blowing, the number of changes.
Oh, yeah, that's the future. Like 6-7 years ago, you had to know your way around a computer pretty well in order to hear Internet radio, and you had to have what would have been at that time a pretty high-end unit. It's just become now more and more accessible and more easy for just the average person to do. So it will continue to evolve like that.
Well, as you continue to evolve your program, and again, people can find out more about it at drdemento.com, drdemento.com, drdemento.com. I know you have heard variations on this statement throughout your career, and will continue to do so. But as somebody who grew up in a tiny, uninteresting town from which there seemed to be for much of my childhood no escape at all, I want to thank you for giving me a virtual window into not just one other world, but to myriad other worlds, and making radio seem like a viable way a viable way to spend my life, and a viable thing to do for a living. So for myself and for a lot of us in radio, I want to thank you for being out there and continuing to do what you do, my friend.
Thank you for listening, and thanks for your support, and don't forget to stay demented.